questions that could reveal your purpose in life? What if there were questions that could surface the change most meaningful to you? And what if answering those questions would give you the power to ignite? Welcome to the Illumify Game Changer podcast. These are big conversations that lead to self-discovery. Together, let's embark on the leader's journey and ignite meaningful change. If leaders can't engage others, they won't be able to ignite their meaningful change. But don't be fooled that when you speak, they are even listening. There are a lot of reasons why they may not even hear you. As Jonathan learns in this episode, it's better to know what those are before you open your mouth to speak. Jonathan, given everything that emerged in the last number of conversations, is there anything you want to highlight that you've reflected on?
Yes, the one thing I would want to highlight is something you said about leadership, Marianne, which resonates with me very deeply, and that's the central importance of language. And you set out very clearly how it begins with language. Language is the start of the beginning of the energy, the first move. I'm paraphrasing here, but that really means a lot to me and gives me confidence and a sense of my own ability to become a leader in my way, in my fashion, yeah, and because of my own personal relationship with and love of language. So that meant a lot to me and was very helpful. So thank you for that. And I thought it was definitely worth repeating that.
Excellent. Thank you.
Illumify. To illuminate the change that matters most to you. Amplify it so it also matters to those who can help realize it. And unify to ally in thought and action as a collective to ignite meaningful change.
Okay, you have read that Illumify definition probably countless times at this point, Jonathan. Is there anything there?
No, I was just happy to find the word collective again, because I had not remembered that from the card, but it came up in our conversation a few moments ago, and that it strikes me as a helpful, very helpful word to understand who this first group of people are who can help.
Yeah,
good. Collective sounds like it's the word that helps me most to see this.
For clarity's sake, I'd like to define collective. So as a noun, it's members of a cooperative enterprise.
Collective feels good.
Okay.
It feels good.
Excellent. Okay. We should use words with precision. And certainly when it comes to interpreting our words, the words we use matter. The guidelines card, please.
Yes. Number one, answer from your heart, not from your head. Two, listen to yourself with care and focused attention. Three, do not judge the validity or viability of your answers. This is about expressing significant new initiatives or ideas that do not yet exist.
Do not yet exist.
Yes, I think that's a very important point on the card there.
So a shared home does not yet exist. Your concept of a...
No.
So know that, right? And if it doesn't exist, people have no experience that they can draw from, unless that experience is sparked by what you say, so they can begin to imagine it. Please answer the next Amplify question, Jonathan.
What concerns them about this? Why would it matter to them at this moment? Are they concerned enough about how it is now to be willing to evoke change? could they have concerns about this change itself and its impact on them? Why would it matter to them at this moment? If I'm looking at, walking towards the people who might help me to ignite this change, the people I would need, it would matter to them because in this first instance, I believe we would already share some of these concerns. If I arrived at these people and sat with them and they just looked at me with a furrowed brow and a puzzled gaze, completely baffled by what I'm saying or shocked, surprised, then for me that would not be right. It would feel wrong, and that's not what I would expect. I would expect at least some openness from these people, because I know them. It's this first group of people, the first people that I would go to.
So the pronoun them.
Yes.
Who do you see? What concerns them about this?
I see.
And I know you're starting with your inner circle. Yes. We've spoken about that, but also see beyond.
Yeah. Well, what I would want is that irrespective of where they are in their particular lives right now, and irrespective of their own levels of comfort and where their own position in life may shield them from many of the things that we've talked about already, that part of the vision that is rooted in loneliness and homelessness, that even then amongst this people, some aspect, important aspects of the vision would resonate with them, that they would recognize part of it that speaks to them, even if they might be living in very comfortable circumstances and not feel lonely in any way.
So concerns is the key here. What would concern them about it? First of all, you confirm, and again, based on who you see, the people you know, good starting point for sure, and there's a comfort level there, but maybe the people you know are representative of others like them. And what can bond and start to form a collective is a shared concern or set of shared concerns. But in the case where the concern hasn't even been expressed, no one said it out loud, you know, it's one thing to go to a group where they speak about whatever that is regularly, passionately, overtly, or covertly, but they speak about it. But in this case, you're going out with something that, well, let's start with that and let's go back to your inner circle. Is it something you've talked about using this vision, these words, these phrases of yours?
No.
Okay.
No.
All right. But, so let's start there. So you put a face on a few, mm-hmm, and you start to share it. What could their concerns be in hearing you?
Well, if we come to the card, the question is what concerns them about this? And that links naturally to the next question, why would it matter? Why does it matter to them? But then the final question is, could they have concerns? And when we say we have concerns,
right,
it's another way of saying, I have some concerns about this. I'm a bit worried.
I'm on the fence. I don't know if I want to act yet. Convince me I have some concerns.
Yeah.
Or it could affect me negatively. There are all kinds of
right
potential concerns.
But then in the first question, why would it matter to them? That's more the sense of, whether somebody is engaged or indifferent?
Well,
why would it matter to them at this moment?
You've answered that question in another format as an actual question. This is part of the prompt. And it matters only if, in this case, in this context, Jonathan, if they have a concern that your vision could resolve, then it would matter to them. But it's about addressing, knowing and addressing concerns in order to, because if we have a concern, it can impede us from acting. So focus on what the concerns could be.
The concerns could be, well, the first one is that they are mostly happy where they are at the moment. They have a high degree of security.
And what does security look like for them?
I'm assuming it would be secure employment, no financial worries, living in a place that feels safe day to day. And so if you put all of those things together, this might feel irrelevant to them.
And could it be, because I'm doing fine, just fine right now. My life is good. I'm secure now. And I have a home, whatever that home may be. Now you're telling me I need to share my home. Could there be a concern there?
I think if you put it like that, yes.
Concerns are not always logical. Some are fear-based, illogical, but fear-based.
Yeah.
So let's try together to surface all the potential concerns that these individuals may have.
Right. But these are people who I would hope to bring on board. Is that?
Yes. And you may not know them yet.
Right. I'm just questioning myself here whether, given the nature of my vision, I'm not sure whether I would approach people who are very comfortable with their lives at the moment. I'm not sure I...
Oh, see, that helps you define, who do I need to reach? That's absolutely valid. Do you think people who are, quote, comfortable and secure in their lives would care about this? Would they even listen? Doesn't apply to me? And don't speak, just as you don't speak, just you do in these conversations, don't speak from your head. You speak from your heart. So go to their hearts if they care about something. Would they care? Would it concern them that they hear we need to live in truth? Would they say, oh, I live in truth. I'm my true self. I embrace the differences, all the various threats of your vision.
Some people would be worried. Some people would reject language that talks about the soul, about dignity. That would be too heavy for some people, I'm sure. I think some people would be, they'll be squeamish about those words and ideas because they would suggest some religious aspect. I think some people would be concerned about, would not respond well to the idea of truth, the notion of truth, because it's too harsh, it's too self-righteous. Again, perhaps partly because there's some people might see a religious connotation in there, or that it's too much discipline in there, maybe.
Too much discipline, Jonathan? Can you embellish that?
That a vision which says we need to speak truth to one another. I can see some people rejecting that because it's too moral. There's a moral overtone to it that would be too heavy, I think, for some people.
So you've said the truth, speaking truth might be too harsh, and now you've said it could be too moral.
For some people. Yeah.
Can you explain that a little more?
That it's, some people would
reject the idea of others giving advice on how to live their lives.
Judging them?
Yeah, there's a judgmental aspect, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So unless you speak truth, you are less than, you're failing. What would the connotation be there? Could it be that some people have never spoken truth or been in a milieu, an environment where truth was spoken? Are we so inured to the truth now?
Well, my starting point here is the position that truth holds within a community.
Yeah.
And how it's celebrated, elevated within a community, so that there is a pursuit of truth across many, many different parts of society, from the media to the judicial system to the world of art and culture, where in each instance the pursuit is very, very different.
Yeah.
And it's not the same truth.
But you've spoken about the pursuit of,
yes,
the truth being so critical.
Yes,
yeah?
Yes.
Okay.
And I think at some point when I talk about, in the vision, talking about truth around the kitchen table, that it, at some point it starts at home, that's not to give the sense that we suddenly need to become better people, and humans will always struggle to tell the truth, I'd say particularly to themselves in their own mind, but also in their most intimate relationships. We know this. I think if we want to give back to the idea of truth, the power that it can have within a community, the very positive power, then I'm not sure that we can completely separate that from the individual and the life of the individual. I think at the very least, there has to be a common recognition of why this is important, and that truth isn't merely a set of public democratic institutions or something that infuses certain professions, be it journalism or the judicial system. There has to be part of this which is personalized, and where as individuals we recognize that truth is important.
And Jonathan, you've spoken about truth in community, you've mentioned institutions, you've spoken about the individual response could be, you know, don't judge me, don't accuse me of being that, whatever. So that's the individual versus the community, the collective. But you now have just said so astutely that it has to be personal. The individuals have to get that incredible value of truth that you see. They have to get it individually, yeah?
I think, yes, we have to have an understanding as individuals, whoever we are,
yeah,
and wherever we live and whatever our conditions within the community, we do, I think, need to have a common sense, a very clear sense of why this matters, and that it's ultimately, well, I was going to say ultimately, actually most immediately, directly a matter of life and death, where if we are not able to share a common factual reality around us in the place that we live, then we put ourselves in immediate danger.
How?
Well, I'll give you two examples. The ancient example where we first discover this as human beings, and this is the truth of storytelling. If I'm in my tribe, my community, and I come back covered in blood, and somebody says, "What happened?" and I say, "Well, I got to the edge of the forest, and at the far edge of the forest, there was a bear, and he almost killed me. I just managed to escape." The telling of that story to people who have not seen the bear and who may not know what a bear is. That might have been my first confrontation with the bear. So it's new to everybody.
Yeah.
So they have to believe my story. And I'm telling them a story so that they don't get covered in blood. I'm saving them. So what's happening there is that through storytelling, you are creating a common factual reality where there's a very important piece of information. That corner of the forest is now out of bounds until we find a solution about how to deal with the bear, which may mean we have to uproot and find somewhere safer to live. Fast forward to a modern scenario, and you can take this to absurd extremes. We share a common factual reality when we drive, that there is one side of the road that we drive on and not the other.
Ideally.
And that varies, yeah. And that varies between Canada, the US, Britain and mainland Europe. We all drive on one side, but not the other.
So we again, blame you English for
well,
that,
it's, by the we, way. We do seem to be at the center of this. So that's just the most immediate life and death.
Yes, good examples.
Value of truth.
Yeah.
As we expand from that, obviously it becomes more complex and you end up with much more difficult truths within ourselves about who we are and who we're trying to be and how we behave with other people. And that's where it becomes thickly coated in morality and, you know, the search for the truth about ourselves. So it has many.
It does.
It has many, many different dimensions and different weights and resonances.
Yeah.
And we'll have for different people.
Exactly. And so when you use the powerful words and phrases, declarations that you've constructed, for example, around truth,
yes,
knowing now, having surfaced that truth in itself could raise concerns that you have to address to whatever degree, ensure there is an understanding of the value of truth, why truth matters. Don't assume that they know it the way you know it.
Yes. I mean, and this, I think this brings us back to, for me, it's almost a test for the vision where I don't think my vision works unless it applies potentially to each and every individual. In other words, I would want it to be a vision which is not powerful and inspiring for one group of people over here or one group of people over there, one group of people who are suffering in this way or one group of people who are suffering in another way. For me, that it's not so much a failing of the vision, it's because the vision is trying to get to something universal and where even if you were living in the most comfortable circumstances and felt no insecurity in your life whatsoever, you would still feel why these things are important.
So could it be...
And that's, know, just to finish that, because there's a...
Yeah, go.
And that's not in the, if we're talking about comfort and security, and at some point that it becomes a question of wealth and prosperity. I don't want this to be a vision that appeals to people's sense of charity, for example, or solidarity. Again, I'm trying to dig below that level to something that could apply to each individual and without. The other trap here is the common denominator, that you come up with something that's so wishy-washy and just hits a low common denominator.
Right, yeah.
That's not where we are either, because that's not a vision.
No. Your vision has so many facets to it, so many aspects to it, that when you go back to where you started with the individual, you said would be secure, you know, life is good, fully employed, beautiful home. Well, parts of what you're saying they may not relate to, but there may be something missing that when they see it, when they hear it from you, they can scan their lives and go, oh, well, I have A, B, C, D, but I don't have F or E, and I can see how those elements that Jonathan's vision of a shared home could matter to me, do matter to me, and I didn't know I was missing them.
I mean, one very real thing, one very real aspect that occurs to me now, you and I have touched on this in various conversations, is I can imagine people resisting this part of the vision today, right now in 2024, because of the, I would say, the last decade or so that we've lived through, and where this phenomenon has become worse. It's always been there. There's nothing new here, but I do feel that it's become worse. And I think certain statistics back that up. And that's precisely our ability to share a common factual reality. So the danger here is that truth becomes politicized in a very tribal way, and where it becomes your truth against mine. And that's where you have people in, where it becomes very angry, and a very angry conversation, and a very poisonous source of conflict.
When those individual truths are diametrically opposed to each other.
And where we can't even agree on what has actually happened.
Transpired.
And this is where my vision confronts one of the biggest social and cultural and political challenges we face today, which is how do we get people to back down, calm down, be ready again to have conversation,
to have dialogue with each other.
Yes, yeah. And where. I mean, I think this is where the second part of the vision about needing this deep need for our neighbours, whether that's in the next street, the next village, the next town, but also the next country, ultimately, because I'm also very clear this is not a national vision that would be confined to one community. That doesn't work either, because then it's not universal. But I think this is where the truth, if part three is the truth and part two is our deep, deep need for each other, not just out of friendship and solidarity, but so that we become the best version of ourselves. I think this is where they're sort of bleeding into each other, or working off each other, feeding into each other, supporting each other, which is that it's that there is a moment of truth. There is a moment of truth in every person's life where we feel deeply and urgently that we need the other person. And this can be in all sorts of scenarios. I've been extremely lucky not to have had any serious accidents in my life, but I can imagine that at the moment where you feel a doctor has saved your life, that must be an incredible experience and must be very powerful. And I can only imagine that it would change somebody profoundly.
Sometimes only temporarily, unfortunately.
Well, but yeah. Yes, yeah. Of course.
But you're saying that those two parts intersect.
That there is deep, deep truth in our need for each other. Deep truth, I think, in the idea that we cannot, it goes beyond the ability to solve problems. It goes beyond the idea that we need our colleagues and our neighbours and fellow citizens to solve certain problems. Of course we do. That's not controversial. It's rather this idea that it's only through our relations with other people that we pull ourselves out of isolation. And this is where the isolation, we felt isolation in recent years because of the pandemic. We felt it because of social media, which seems often to divide us rather than bring us together. There are so many aspects of our life today which isolate us. Millions of people now working at home. It's becoming normalized very, very quickly. And so this throws up a huge challenge, which is how do we live together when so many parts of our day-to-day life are separating us and isolating us? And I think this is where, if we're not careful, we will lose the ability to confront the truth. Because the more we are isolated, the more we are separate, the more we are able, and indeed in some cases encouraged, to listen to ourselves, then there is real danger. Then there is real danger. Probably the most real, tangible example of this is the echo chamber. We've all heard the phrase over the last 10 years many times, often in the context of social media, but also the traditional media, that one side, one tribe only listens to itself. They only listen to their sources of information. But I think there's a deeper human problem there that has always existed and will continue to exist. It may simply have become more difficult over the last 10 years. And this is where the truth comes in. Because if we're not able to have conversations with other people, if we're not able to share a common human experience as we walk out into the street, as we walk around town, as we walk around the city, then our ability to live together and to act together is massively, massively diminished. We lose trust. And there lies some form of falsehood. If we're looking for the opposite of truth, there lies some sort of falsehood where we might feel comforted by having our view of the world constantly played back to us. That's very normal and human. And I'd say there's nothing
familiar.
Yeah. And how could you? We need that as well. We do need that as well. But we need ways of living together which bring us out of our isolation and which confront us with difficult truths and which confront us with the moments where we're perhaps turning away from the truth or hiding in some way.
You have put this into the context, Jonathan, all of the second element I'm going to refer to as we need each other, not just from a dependency point of view, but because it is through being together, through conversations, through communal whatever, that we become our best selves. You've said that. So if you go back to concerns on that element, if you say to people, we need each other, therefore live in a shared home, you're speaking in the context of, as you alluded to, the pandemic, where isolation became the norm because the very prospect of being together was potential threat to life, is how many saw it, right? So to now, in the wake of that, go out and say, oh, we need to live together, we need to be together, and you've got some part of their belief system and their experience refuting that. But my neighbor is a threat to me. Don't talk to me about living with my neighbor. I am better served by isolation. And on the other side of that, the various elements of isolation today, virtual work serves people. Remote work serves people. You know, now you can pretty much live where you want to live for many people, white collar workers, for example, because they can work from anywhere. So I'm in isolation, but I'm living on a beach. That's great. And it is pretty great. So now you're saying to them, don't be isolated, whatever that looks like for you. Don't separate yourself. Mm. We need each other. So what do you need to say to address those concerns?
Right. Well, this is where the vision starts to operate as a sphere, where each of the parts are working together at the same time. You know, they're not a list that you run through top to bottom, tick off.
They're interconnected too, as you've seen now with truth and
yes,
we need
completely, because to your list there that you've rightly put together of people who, through their own experience, would reject intimate, common shared life right now. I can add a whole group of other people who, for good reason, find it difficult to spend time with other people because they're introverted, because they have social anxiety. I've seen this up close.
It brings some stress and angst being in the company of others.
So this brings me back to the first part. For the sake of this discussion now, let's really simplify this. Let's really distill this down to three parts. If the first part is about our dignity and freedom as individuals, then that part of the vision talks about the vital starting point that we come into this life as individual souls with dignity, a sacred dignity which nobody can ever diminish. And from that comes a freedom to choose your path in life. That's non-negotiable for me. But it's also reconcilable and ultimately sits very comfortably with parts two and three. For me, there is no contradiction at all in the idea that we are free to choose our own path, but that we also need other people.
You see, though, Jonathan, I hope you see that. You see it. You know it. And now you need others to see it, to share, if they are the ones, right? To unify together.
Yes.
So that's why, as you're digging and digging here, and I so appreciate that this is digging, surfacing concerns, they can be obstacles unless you address them, unless you turn the light on and say, ha, I know that. I see that you think that.
Yes.
And help them resolve them.
Yes. Yeah. I think I reached I started to see towards the end of London and then perhaps more clearly in Toronto that there are parts of the vision which are not breaking new ground. They're not breaking with the past because they're still there around us. An attachment to talk about our individual freedom in 2024 would be taken for granted.
Not in 21, though, right? Not in 2021. Would it have been taken for granted?
I think it's still taken for granted across the West.
Okay.
I think so.
Okay.
I'm not saying it isn't in various forms being curtailed and endangered. That's a different question.
Okay.
Likewise, our need for each other, I don't think is controversial. If I put it in very simple terms, just for the sake of this argument, for the large parts of the West who still believe deeply in the need for systems of social support, whether that's investment in public goods such as education, health, or the systems of taxation that provide for those public goods, or the welfare provisions that support people in moments of need, this is not controversial either. Where I sense I'm adding something new here, and this is where the whole begins to work as an entity, as an organic entity, the vision, is that the diversity that I'm talking about in the vision is not the visible one that we see right. in a crowd of people.
Yeah.
And which is important. I'm really interested here in the diversity inside each of us. I think we are so diverse, each of us as individuals. I think there are so many different colours, shapes and sizes and sounds inside each of us. I think we're utterly, utterly diverse, each of us, within our own hearts, our own minds, our own experience, our own ways of seeing the world. And so the vision is trying to respond to that and to give space and to celebrate that diversity that is inside each of us, inside, because that's the source of our brokenness. That's the source of our need for each other. It's the source of our incompletion. And so we have this idea that through our relations with others, we find the missing pieces of ourselves. And then truth comes in as the third part to give it a protective coating. If you were designing a normal political community, you would say, well, the rule of law is ultimately what provides the protection. It's the threat of violence within the community. If you do something wrong, the police will come along and lock you up, or they'll fine you. Likewise, the protection towards the outside comes from the armed forces. A democracy is soft, so it needs a hard coating of the military defending the frontier. Fine, I'm not disputing that, but where I'm trying to go further is that truth, I think, is in some ways the best and the most necessary protection for the community itself, because truth leads to clarity, shared sense of purpose. If we don't have truth, we forget or we avoid or ignore the people who are suffering. When we avoid suffering, when we forget the people who are suffering, there is falsehood there. There is denial. We close our eyes. There is untruth there. So I'm trying to get to this idea that it's truth amongst us, the pursuit of truth, how that leads to trust, and how that gives a deep, deep strength that runs through the whole community. So that's a quick picture of how the three parts all work together. And coming back to your question, Marianne, this is, if one part of this first group that I need to convince, the collective, if they hear one part of this, they could easily be put off. Truth. Ugh. Are we in church? Why is he taking us back to church?
Are you talking truth with a lowercase T or an uppercase T? Could that be the question?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because truth in itself shouldn't take you back to church necessarily.
No, right? No, absolutely.
You shouldn't have to go there to find truth.
No, absolutely. And for me, the idea of soul, that each child comes into the world with a soul. So not, again, what are we doing? It goes beyond a legal guarantee of human rights. It's more than that. There is something unique and vital and precious. And the reason we use the word soul there is because our dry, secular, political language doesn't give us what we need.
Right.
Doesn't get to that. So we borrow from religion.
And you're really good at borrowing, I have to say.
We have to.
You have to. And even then, as you've said, language has its limitations to some degree. If you had a number of individuals in front of you and together and individually, they had the potential to help you realize, to do their part, whatever part that is, small or large. And you know, based on a conversation, perhaps based on familiarity, that some, all, one has been burned in the past by someone's failure to be reliable. Okay, so you may not be able to resolve that, because that is a real experience, and it creates a belief to whatever degree. I can't always rely on people. I can never rely on people. I can only rely on some people, whatever the magnitude. Yeah. All right. So recognizing that whoever that holds that concern, and you can't refute it because, again, that's been their experience, then it's an opportunity for you to appeal to something else. Yes, maybe that's a bit of an obstacle, but if I go in over here and appeal to their sense of knowing that this, and maybe it's not the need each other, maybe it's another part of your vision, this will draw them. And to the point where it allows them to, maybe they'll still hold that belief, but they'll be able to carry it forward. They'll be able to move forward despite it being some level of load on them. Can you see that? This is why it's really important in having a vision, being able to, and creating something that doesn't exist yet, to know where people are at. Because if one door is closed, you may be able to go through another door. Take them on a new path to get there together that they haven't yet experienced. And the thing is, this may be the optimist in me, I must admit, but the thing is, imagine if they went on that journey with you and then they look back someday, because together you've created this new reality. And they look back to 2 years earlier, 10 years earlier, 2 months earlier, and they can see that the new life they have in this shared home makes whatever that negative, painful experience diminish, be irrelevant, maybe even be out of their insides altogether. Gets back to the definition of the amplify element within Illumify, which is to enable you to express it so it is meaningful to them too. And unless you go in ahead of time, this is what I call the due diligence of your communication, and it's often missed. So you go in with a big vision, you're excited about it, you see the possibilities. They can't, because they're holding these concerns that blind them to the possibilities. And unless you can surface those concerns in advance through your due diligence, heavy work. It's painstaking work. I'm sure you can see that. I use the term, as I said, due diligence, because I'll give you some examples that, you know, yeah, that maybe more people would be familiar with. Yes, this is my methodology. Yes, you know, it was developed for a reason, in part because in my work, and particularly in crisis communication counsel, I would hear people be unheard when it was critical that they be heard. And so it's important that when you open your mouth, you know with the greatest level of certainty that you can. It's never, you know, perfect, but the greatest, it's not carved in stone is what I'm going to say. But to the greatest degree possible, you know that what you're going to say is significant enough for people to hear. They've got to be able to listen to it. And if it doesn't matter to them, they're out, they're gone, and you can't get them back in. So this is about doing in advance as much work as you can to ensure, first of all, starting with who are you speaking to? Who do you need to reach? Because as you've identified, yes, this is universal. Your vision is universal. And it, at one level, the universe, yes, and then bring it down to other levels. Like you could look, because you've spoken about it a lot, at this applying specifically to Europe. So that may be, on depending on your perspective, the local level, right? Or the regional level. So there can be many levels. And when you're speaking to, we'll call it a level, group, an audience, a particular segment, you need to know as best you can. Who's in there? What do they care about? We're just on concerns now. There's more coming. There are six elements of what I call due diligence. Know what they're worried about, what they're concerned about that could prevent them from acting, from thinking and acting in the ways that will help you realize your vision. Concerns. What are they interested in? What would appeal to them? What do they like? And frame it that way. Okay, so that's two. Then what's their awareness of this now? If people are walking around in their own little worlds and blind and, you know, for expediency, they're working hard, they're completely unaware of the very concept of a shared home, for example, or truth or whatever. So awareness is the third component. The fourth is, what's their understanding of it? And understanding is a relative thing. So you, and I keep hammering this for you because it's so important, Jonathan, you see it. Others do not, cannot, certainly not to the same degree you see it. And so if this were a painting, you started with a blank canvas when we began this process, would you agree? You didn't know what your vision was going to be, right? So then strokes, as I've listened to these recordings, I'm hearing, it's quite interesting, pretty early on, some of what you now have as your vision, they came in pieces, little threads, phrases, powerful, powerful threads and phrases. But you started putting a broad stroke. What I imagine is a wide, what would that be, a half-inch paintbrush, a stroke goes on, just a little stroke, a shape, a curve perhaps. And then, as Jonathan continued, another one. And then, so an image of something started to take shape. Now, you've got that. You left Illuminate with that, and it's a big something. Now we've got some magnificent image on the page. Okay, so now you're at the fine brushwork. Is that the right expression? Because you're putting the fine strokes on it based on, you can see the edges, you can see how to fill it in, but you have to help other people see it too. You know, unless you're a Picasso and a modern artist. We're talking more of the traditional. So let me go back. This is concerns. Then we have interests. Then we have awareness. What's their understanding of what it means? And that's already where I'm starting to ask you questions of what it means to share a home, to speak truth to one another, to be our best selves. What does that mean? They may never have heard it before. It's easier to get that if you were talking about, I don't know, biomedical engineering. If you were giving a talk on biomedical engineering and you knew your audience was filled with biomedical engineers, you could speak at a different level of detail and complexity, yeah, because they're already there. Versus if you had a class of 10th graders coming in to hear a biomedical engineer speak, you would speak of it in a different way, very different way. So that you want to map the level of understanding, and it's not derogatory, and it is never about sixth graders. If you know that old adage, speak to them as if they're sixth grade audience. No, but map it to their level of understanding, and it has to be exact, because if it's above, they'll tune out. If it's below, they're bored, they'll tune out. So you have to know their level of understanding about this, yeah? So those are four. Two more. Values and beliefs. Know as best you can what they value, and know as best you can about relevant beliefs about this. And we've been surfacing some of that in concerns. But our ability to listen and understand, so listen, hear, understand, and respond is based on all of this. It's based on what we hear. Because at the most rudimentary level, when we hear someone speak, we, and the research identified this 20 years ago for me, when I was building my diagnostic. When we hear someone speak, we want, and this is more true than ever, we want to feel that they're speaking to us. We want to be recognized as being part of that conversation, even when there are 1,000 people in the room. Speak to me because I'm mad. Like, recognize me, see me, know I am here. You're nodding, Jean. Do you get that?
Totally. I've been in the education system for 15 years. And then I moved towards more alternative type of education, right? And we started the new, let's say, project in Toronto. And there are more and more people, they're not happy with the regular system, right? Yeah. So they're looking for new ways.
Yeah.
So when they see what you have to offer, they get excited. Yeah, oh, that's, love your vision, that's amazing. Okay, like, I'm in. And then as the days goes, weeks goes, and concern starts to emerge. Yeah, but what about the, because they're still pulled by the hold or the attachment of what they were used to.
And you're pulling them toward the unknown, mm-hmm. the unfamiliar. They don't know it yet.
Exactly.
Doesn't fully exist for them yet, right?
Exactly. So all those concerns were, what about the academic? What about the age of the student? They're all coming. So as we, that's why the test period is, the first year was kind of a test where all those questions were coming.
Yeah.
We're like, well, now we need to talk about that before, like,
so you're kind of prepared to answer
exactly,
and
like
speak
we already
to
have
it.
Those answers before they ask the questions.
Yeah.
So we already talk to them because we understand your concern. Like, you might be asking about or thinking about the academic part. Mm-hmm. Here's how we proceed.
Yeah.
Here's
So, but if you didn't surface that in advance, you would lose an opportunity because you would be unprepared, or you'd be speaking to the wrong people.
Mm-hmm.
It's about being able to identify who could this appeal to and appeal to them enough that they would be willing to help realize it.
Yeah. If not, it's they're in, but there's one leg out.
Yes, that's right. And then you've got counter forces, right? Yeah.
So that's why I was nodding because
it's been
2 years and like the vision is amazing. We can see it clearly, but to make sure that people are fully committed in, there's a lot of questions, concern that needs to be addressed. If not, it becomes resistance.
Yeah, blocks it's resistance. And it can be quiet resistance. It. They just quietly withdraw. Yeah. So if you're a leader in a room, I see this all the time, the individual puts together a communication and it can be really, well written and could be written by a professional even, and they get out and they deliver it. And everyone applauds. Yay, wonderful, right? Great job. And then the people who help them write it or create it run over and say, great job, boss. Fantastic. Really? Follow those people when they leave the room, virtual room or otherwise, and see what they heard. Do it right away. What did you hear him or her say? And then do it a week later. See if they remember anything. But here's the real acid test. Follow them to see what they do. Have you changed the way they think about this? Have you invoked them to act on it? Or are we still status quo? Nothing has changed. And then you've got a lost opportunity. Every time you speak, you have an opportunity collect, that's not the right word. You have an opportunity, first of all, to engage others in listening and in helping you do what you're there to do that you cannot do alone, that change.
Yeah.
Jonathan, I'm going to add one more element to the due diligence, and it's in part because here we are sitting in Denmark. When I arrived here earlier this year for a lengthy stay, having been raised with Danish traditions by a Danish mother, Danish food, even some of the language, I assumed I was pretty familiar with the Danish culture. I learned almost immediately that I had assumptions that were misassumptions about it. And some of those surfaced in trivial things, didn't really matter, and I quickly would rectify a conversation or whatever. But others were very significant. And it was only by quickly assimilating that I was in a different culture that I could respond, what I would say, as my best self in different scenarios. So culture can have a huge bearing on how we interpret something. And I'll give you just a little example of it, the one I shared with you, Brittany, earlier today, and the one that invokes our dear friend Miriam and how I met her early on my arrival in Copenhagen. I was at the door of the condo building trying to get in the front door. I think it was day two upon arrival, and I had bags of groceries, and I had a fob that I wasn't familiar with that opened the front door to the building. So I had put the bags of groceries down, and I was searching for the fob, probably in my purse, and I heard a voice about 10 feet away say, "I'll help you, wait, I'll open the door for you." First of all, it was English. That was a bit surprising. And I turned, and a woman approached, and she reached in front of me, opened the door, and we went into the elevator together. Turns out she literally lived in the condo right beside the one I was renting. We then got to know each other. She took me out to lunch, which was so kind of her, the following week. And I said to her then, "How did you know I was English? Why did you not speak to me in Danish?" And she said to me, she's not Danish herself. She's an international executive. And she said to me, "Well, when I said to you, called to you that I'd help you open the door, you turned and smiled." I thought, okay. And she said, "Had you been Danish, I might have offended your sense of independence by implying that you needed help opening the door." So that's a simple thing, simple statement. "Let me help you, let me open the door for you," could have offended based on the cultural interpretation of that. So culture is another one. These are all with respect to doing due diligence, reflecting yourself to whatever degree, researching whatever you can. If you don't know, approach someone and ask them if that person is representative of who you, or someone you know. In this case, you're talking about beginning perhaps still with your first degree of relationships, those you know best, those you're familiar with. You could, maybe you're arranging a small group of people, you could reach out. I'm putting this into the corporate context where my clients would, if they're speaking to their leadership team and there are 200 of them coming to a town hall or something, I'll counsel them to go to a couple of them, representative of different, I don't know, region or division or whatever, and say, what are you concerned about these days? What's troubling you? What's keeping you up at night? What do you care about? Interests. So concerns, interests. How much do you know about this initiative? What do you not understand about it? What do you believe to be true about this? Again, what matters to you? What are your values about this? And in Toronto, on the cultural front, we have at last count something like 150 different cultures represented living in a shared home of Toronto. So there's that level. And it's not to be daunting. I don't want you to be daunted by this, but to recognize it and do as much. If you want to call it testing, absolutely fine. Due diligence before you venture broadly forth through amplifying your figuring out where are they at, what do they need to hear that will compel them to respond, not force, entice them to respond because of what I'm saying, because I see it and they don't yet. It matters to me, and I am determined to find a way to express it so it matters enough to them too that they will help me realize it. That's why this matters, the due diligence. Thank you, Jonathan. This question gets to the heart of another prime reason why a leader's meaningful change fails to ignite. Despite the fact that the question serves to surface the concerns others may have about his vision, Jonathan begins to answer by listing why it matters. And yes, it does. But at this point, maybe it only matters to him. This is another of the Amplify questions that is deliberately designed to help him express his vision in the way that matters to them too, as they're the ones who can help him realize it. Unless leaders are aware of the concerns and can address and ideally resolve them, others will not embrace the vision. They'll resist. It may look like they're listening, but they could have well tuned out. And that may not be evident until you see that they fail to act on what you've said. Surfacing concerns is part of what I call the due diligence that is so vital to a leader's ability to engage, align, and mobilize those who can help ignite the change. As I list in this conversation, there are many facets to consider. It may seem like a big investment of time and effort on the leader's part, but the return can be invaluable as it identifies exactly what needs to be said in order for them to listen and respond in the ways that help realize the meaningful change. The leader's journey continues. Stay tuned. If listening to this Illumify Game Changer podcast is of value to you, please like it on this platform and share it with those who could ignite meaningful change. It's here, as am I, to be of service. I'm Marianne Gobet. Thank you for accompanying us on the leader's journey. To fully experience the passage to igniting meaningful change, subscribe to the Illumify Game Changer podcast. To learn more about the Illumify Game Changer and how to embark on your own leader's journey, please visit Illumify's website at illumifyinstitute.com. You matter. Step up. Speak up. Together, let's ignite meaningful change.